So I think where we add value as a community bank is we really do want to hear the story behind the business. We want to understand what it is that motivated that individual to start this particular business and where their dreams and their passions and cares and concerns, what it is that they're trying to do inside their community, because they did it for a reason.
Yeah.
They started it for a reason. And it's not always financial reward.
Right.
There was something else there that motivated them to say, I'm going to take a flyer on this business. And the small community banks like us, we thrive on being able to hear that story because it helps us in the context of the risk profile of the organization. If I can sit across from a business owner and I can see in their eyes and hear in their heart the passion that they have associated with the bank, when we get into the gray areas, that helps me with my decision making as I'm thinking about a relationship with that particular company.
Hey, welcome to the More Than Money podcast. This is Chris Burns. So happy you're joining us. Hope you're having a great week. I'm excited about this podcast. Something that I've talked about a lot on the show recently has been my frustration with big banks and the way they take advantage of you and I, of their customers. And there's big ways that that has happened in the last few years. We just have to take a glance at Wells Fargo and the multiple scandals with how millions of clients were taken advantage of by the bank. And then in the small ways, when you go into the bank, are you treated with respect? Are you treated as though that bank is grateful to be holding your money? Or is it kind of an expectation by them? It's almost like they're doing you a favor to hold your money. That has been my experience. And so many of my clients' experiences driving me crazy. And so this podcast is with Mike Sims. Mike is the executive vice president at the Vinings Bank in Atlanta. They are a local bank, but they're doing things truly differently, significantly differently. And there are other banks that are doing this as well, saying we're not going to be that way. We're not going to charge people outrageous fees and then act like we're doing them a favor. We're not going to treat folks that come in here as a number. We're going to actually engage with them in their situation. If you have a hard time, we're going to talk with you about how to help you. That exists. And so my action item here, I don't say this in the podcast much, but my action item is please, 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 if you are used to banking at one of the large, massive banks that's treating you like, you know, without respect and doesn't particularly care about your business, do yourself a favor and find a bank that actually wants your business and treats it as a big deal that you would give your money to them. Because there are banks out there like that, and Vinings Bank is one of those banks. But there are other ones there too, but please take some time to research that because it's a really big deal. So I think this podcast is important because Mike has decades of experience in the banking industry. He can talk from experience about what he's seen, the changes in that industry, and then how that's changing now. But let me give you just one thing that blew my mind. One of my biggest areas of frustration is the way banks charge fees, and ATM fees are massive. Overdraft fees are the worst here, right? We've seen people, you've had this happen to you before. You don't realize a charge is coming through, and maybe you haven't transferred money in time. Whatever it is, you get hit with overdraft fees, and those can be $35 per fee. I've had people come in with hundreds of dollars in fees from a single day. Okay, listen to this. Vinings Bank does not charge overdraft fees. They don't charge them. I couldn't believe it when Mike told me that. It doesn't mean they're okay with you just charging and charging and charging. If you have a repetitive issue with this where you constantly are overdrafting the account, they're going to come talk to you about it, and eventually they're going to close your account because that's healthy, right? It's not good to overdraft all the time. But if you're someone who accidentally overdrafts, they're not going to charge you a fee. Holy cow. That's just not done. At the large banks, you're paying amazing amounts of fees for that kind of stuff. They just, on almost every level, they've done away with every fee that's unreasonable that they can. And that's exciting stuff to me. So again, there are banks out there doing things differently. I hope you enjoy this conversation. If you have any questions about it or want to dig in deeper about your situation, please jump on my website. It's mylifeismore.com. You can ask any question. I will get back to you personally. You can also listen to past shows and podcasts we've done. Again, mylifeismore.com. And if you want to learn more about Vinings Bank and what they're doing, talk to Mike about that. You can go to viningsbank.com and just see everything that's going on around Atlanta as they continue to grow. Again, viningsbank.com. And I hope you enjoy this conversation with Mike Sims, the Executive Vice President at Vinings Bank. that we always want a narrative. Humans, we tend towards narratives, and yes. So we want to be able to say very clearly, this is what caused this, and here, and let's wrap it up, and now we know why it was. The market drops 2 weeks ago. We want a narrative for that. Well, it must be that inflation's rising, right. and now we can all explain it and breathe easy. But sometimes there's just not a clean narrative. I mean, there is one. There is some sort of causal factor, but we don't. It's not always as clean. It's just, those bad guys on Wall Street did two things wrong.
That's right.
But it makes it understandable for us.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. It makes us think that we can write policy and procedure to keep it from happening in the future.
Right. And then we get into real trouble.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And the pendulum swings.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. What were you doing? So I'll hear more of some of your backstory, but when... Pre-financial crisis, what were you? What was your job? Because you've been in the banking industry now for decades, what was your job?
Yeah, so I was working here in Atlanta for SunTrust.
Okay.
And I was in their commercial banking division, and I had a couple of responsibilities. I was over their commercial line of business for two of their geographic regions, their central division and Gulf Coast, North Florida division. And so I was helping commercial bankers by putting in policies and practices, incentive plans and structure and whatnot to help them go help their clients.
Sure.
That would be small business, middle market business, not-for-profit, and government folks, et cetera, and then dealer finance. I actually ran the dealer finance department, which is... If you think about that, it's all the automobile dealers out there that floor plan their automobiles. Mm-hmm. My group was providing the floor plans for all of those clients and customers across the entire SunTrust footprint, which was 16 states, I think, at the time.
Yeah.
And so that's another interesting story, because if you remember, what also took place during that time frame is the bankruptcy of some of the large manufacturers.
Right.
And so all of that was spinning down as well, and consumer confidence was lost, so we weren't selling as many new cars. Everything went to used cars.
Right.
The SARS, which is a seasonal adjusted sales for automobiles, mm-hmm. was... I think at the time was trending around 16 million automobiles, would dip down to nine million cars being sold.
That's how long did it take for that to happen?
It was literally a 3 year period of time from 07 to 10. And they didn't start turning back around probably in about the 12 or 13, 14 time frame where they got back to those levels again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow. So how long did you stay in that position, or how did you see that impact your reality at work? Did everything stay pretty similar, or was there a massive cut in terms of personnel? How did that work for you?
Yeah, it's interesting that there was the banks did they did not escape the downturn.
Sure.
Some numbers would be, at the time that I was working in 2006-2007 time frame, we probably had 250 odd commercial banking RMs, relationship managers, running across the footprint out there. By the time the crisis was done, I was there through 2011, it was down to about 180, 190 or so.
Wow.
Yeah, so significant impact. And it was, again, a spiral impact, because you think, okay, I need efficiency. I'm a bank. We're running at 75% efficiency ratio, and I need to be in the 50s. So I can't afford to take my back office around, because they're supporting everybody I got today. But my front office guys, well, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. I'm not going to get any more business if I take the folks that are on the front out there trying to bring business into me.
Bringing business.
Exactly right. And so it was very draconian efforts to manage efficiency and effectiveness.
I can't imagine, I've been in pressurized jobs, but I can imagine the amount of pressure that at least many folks in the industry felt at that point of just, A, you're wondering about your own job security, I would imagine.
Yeah.
And then having to make those kind of decisions on a regular basis to say, how do we stay viable? And that sounds intense.
Yeah. I think the impact for a lot of the larger institutions, and you probably see this quite a bit today, but they started managing it not for the long-term future,
right,
but for the next 90 days, because I have an earnings report in the next 90 days, and I'm going to have to report on efficiency, and I'm going to have to report on losses, and I'm going to have to report on bad loans, and what does that look like?
Yeah.
And so what that did was it shortened the conversation for the bankers like me. We were now talking week to week,
right,
and how are things changing? And it in commercial business, it just doesn't change that quickly,
right?
You know, but the expectation was, and because of the gain, you're worried about am I going to be employed next week, and who's going to, you know, everything was. The time frames were, you know, crunched significantly.
That's interesting. Yeah, I heard a
high stress.
Interesting interview. You know, Genworth, who's
sure.
still a major player in long term care, but the whole long term care insurance industry has just gone to just ruin. Really, the traditional long term care industry is really in kind of barely struggling for life right now. But a few years ago. You know, Genworth switched from years ago being a mutual company to they switched over to being a stock company, which was a
right.
big trend in insurance companies years ago, right? As this
right.
movement.
Right.
But he was asked to his face, you know, why is it that you guys keep raising the rates on your long-term care insurance products? Because a lot of folks that have long-term care insurance that bought it assuming it was like a life insurance policy. And
sure.
by the way, everyone yeah. listening right now is falling asleep as I discuss the yeah. differences in long-term. But life insurance is just usually fixed payments, depending on the type of insurance. Long-term care, they can get approval from the state to come back and raise your rates. And now over 90% of companies have done that.
Right.
So dramatic. I have one client that calls me every quarter that before I knew them, they bought long-term care policies. And almost every quarter they have an increase. They call me every quarter and say, should we drop it? Okay. But they asked him that, and he gave this the normal answer about some of the underlying conditions, and then he said, and also in the end, we've got to report to shareholders.
Right.
Like, we've got to show a profit.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a huge shift away from being a mutual company back when that wasn't really a concern, and now it's like that actually impacts what we're going to charge. Well, you know, there's a
absolutely.
Practical reality
yeah.
there.
It's driving discussions.
Yeah, that's interesting. So how long did you stay at SunTrust through all that?
Yeah, I was there through... Mid 2011.
Okay.
And actually got an opportunity to join a company that was formed out of the crash, quite frankly, in that State Bank.
Huh. Yep.
And you know, you hear those guys around here in the marketplace. Joe Evans and the team put together 12 failed institutions. So
wow.
Bought 12 charters from failed institutions
wow.
Macon in Atlanta. Primarily real estate oriented banks that got caught by the stuff that was going on around them. Not necessarily bad transactions, bad deals, bad bankers, bad circumstances. And, you know, so those institutions failed. And the FDIC, and no disparaging comments about them, but they got hit with a volume of failed institutions they had never seen before, and they just didn't know how to handle the processing of those. So when an institution fails, the FDIC takes them into receivership, so they now own that financial institution.
Right.
But they don't want to own the
And they're not really in the business of running
banks,
They're
not
right?
in the business of running the banks day-to-day, and they don't want to make decisions on, you know, should I pay this overdraft or should I do this loan or et cetera.
Wow, yeah.
And so... the volume that came in created this little cottage industry of buying failed institutions, and that's where Joe and those guys raised their capital, $300 million, and bought a charter down in Macon, and followed that up with several acquisitions thereafter. Again, primarily real estate-driven institutions, that's what took them down. And they were looking for someone to help them in their commercial and C&I business, commercial
sure.
and industrial business. And so I got the opportunity to go over there and join them and worked for them for about 6 or 7 years as ended up being their chief banking officer and was really responsible for all of their banking franchise outside of the commercial real estate world.
Because they've seen a lot of growth from what I've observed from afar here.
But. Yeah, I think they were $1.8 billion when I joined them. And today they're going to be just under $5 billion, I think.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, most of it through acquisition and then a considerable amount through organic growth.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously one of the reasons we sat down and what I'm interested in understanding and it really when I heard what you were doing, because we've known each other very loosely years ago, but when I heard about what you're doing, I was fascinated to talk with you because we've so many of my clients are either small business owners or considering launching a business, right? A lot of people I talk with, we list out just from the outset, we say, what are your dreams for the future?
Right.
You know, we do some short-term dreams, but what about long-range dreams? And so many people, it's I want to have my own business. I want to move in that direction. But it feels so daunting to do that often. So I heard heard a little bit of what you're up to, but I'd love you just to describe it. So what caused you to leave State Bank, and what are you doing now? Like, what have you moved into?
Yeah, sure. So today I work for Vinings Bank. Mm-hmm. Vinings actually was a financial institution started in 2007. So they came out. They were actually the second to the last charter that was issued in the state of Georgia in July of 2007. Like most of the institutions that were in the banking world at the time, you know, they grabbed their capital and started to deploy it like banks do.
Sure.
And unfortunately, it was at a time when...
And what a time to start a bank.
Exactly.
Holy
right.
Cow.
Well, the three principals, CEO, CFO, and president, are ex-trust company guys, SunTrust guys. And so I knew of those guys through connections with SunTrust folks. But they started the bank in 2007. Did a wonderful job of deploying capital and getting the bank running. As the wheels came off in the 9-10 time frame, like other banks, they struggled.
Yeah.
And rated assets became 100% of capital. And so they were, you know, questioning, are we going to be around for a while? And made some changes in their operating profile that stay today. So you talked a little bit earlier about lessons learned,
yeah,
you know, potential lessons learned. What they decided to do was to work hard on the deposit side of the business. That's what funds banks, that's how they make their money. They bring deposits in and then they lend against those deposits.
Sure.
And so what they decided to do was, instead of bringing those deposits in and putting them back into an uncertain lending market,
mm-hmm,
2010, 2011,
yeah,
wasn't sure what was going on, they developed the capability to invest in tax-free municipals.
Huh.
And so they said, okay, well, what we're going to do is, in order for us to bring the profile of our bank back into a structure that feels better from a long-term longevity perspective, we'll bring those deposits in, we'll put those in tax-free municipals. It gives us good tax-free income, mm-hmm, risk-free to most extent. But it's also... we're buying those from, you know, the city of Milton or the Cobb County Water or whatnot. And so
sure,
it's still lending back into the communities where we live, work, and play.
Right.
But it wasn't in a more risky environment, which was what was going on in the general lending market at the time. Mm. And so if you look at our balance sheet today, we're about $300 million in assets. And about half of those assets are in traditional C&I lending, mm-hmm, the other half is in tax-free municipal bonds.
Wow.
So what it does for us, and this would be, I'm sure some of your listeners would, you know, would appreciate this, it gives us a lot of flexibility.
Yeah.
Because we're very liquid. We've got this investment portfolio out there, but then at the other side, we've got this risk side that provides margin for us as
yeah,
well. And so we spend a lot of time developing relationship with customers to bring in those deposits for us to be able to feed the engine, tax-free municipals, and then also on the lending side. And we won't change that policy. You'll see a lot of folks who are at 110% loan-to-deposit ratio.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very dangerous,
mm-hmm,
very limited flexibility. If any one person or any one group decides they want to take those deposits and go elsewhere, you don't have any funds to support your loans.
Is that still normative to be that stretched? In
yeah,
general?
Yeah. Wow. It's, if you looked at the, it's come down a little bit over the last 3 or 4 years, but in the, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13 time frame, just because of where you were in the market, that was pretty much the norm. You'd see everyone from anywhere from 90 to 110% loan deposit ratio.
Wow.
As the economy has improved over the last 3 or 4 years and the money supply, you know, increased,
yeah,
the bank's loan deposit ratios have improved somewhat. You'll see most of them probably in the 85 to 95 range, but still not much flexibility provided there. So the folks who founded our bank said, look, we don't want to get ourselves caught back in that again. We like this flexibility, so it gives us the opportunity, as they're doing with me, to launch a new bank out here in the North Fulton County.
Wow.
Area. And so I hooked up with these folks, it was probably about 9 months or so ago, and they were looking for a couple of things.
Hmm.
One was to expand the market of their existing footprint. So their worldwide headquarters is on South Atlanta Road in Smyrna.
Okay.
Been there since 2007. Very, very healthy, very, very good bank. And we wanted to be able to create and find a market that looked very similar to that Cobb County market over there. And they wanted all then to have a banker who was in that market and had been in that market for quite some time.
Yeah.
My family and I have lived in Johns Creek and whatnot for 20 plus years at this point. So, you know, what we're all about is we're a commercial bank, and our goal is to help serve and provide for small to medium-sized companies. We love the deposit base, and then obviously serving them as they need capital resources. And I think here's our differentiating, the differentiating aspect of our bank. Every one of the bankers that we have on our team today are ex, if you want to call it, big bank refugees.
Okay.
And what comes with that is, in the case of myself and the three principals of the institution, is you have folks that have really big bank capabilities, big bank skill sets, but really did not enjoy the big bank environment where everything needs to be in a cookie cutter platform. And there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, big banks do that, and they do that very well, and they do that for a reason. They need throughput.
Yeah.
They've got a big engine.
Yeah.
And the more that you can throw through that engine, the more efficient they're going to be. But to think outside of their boxes that they put there causes kinks in their pipes, and they the throughput slows down. So if they have folks that are out there on the front line and they have to think about or ask questions of their clients, and their clients say, well, I'd like to turn this piece, you know, this page this way, or to turn that page this way. That causes issues with them on the throughput side.
Yeah.
That's where we thrive. So we've got the big bank skill sets. We like scrambled eggs and problems on the table and talking about folks to figure out what it is that it works best in their needs. I can bring the bank to you. I know what the bank needs to make money and how we can make money and how to structure things and et cetera. What I think we bring for startup companies and all the way to, you know, large institutions that are organizations, $75 million, $100 million in revenue, is that big bank skill set and capability. And the been there, done that, got the T-shirt kind of thought process.
Right.
But the willingness to provide that in with a community banking heart.
Yeah.
So it is very much... you know, sitting down and just like you do and talking with folks and figuring out what works, what doesn't work, what are you looking for, and let's solve the problem for both of us.
Yeah.
Mutually beneficial.
Give me okay, so I think a lot of people listening are, they may be entrepreneurial, they may have a business, or they just, you know, they're just interested in this in general and in finance and learning more about it. But from on a story perspective, because if you actually bring it down to, you know, brass tacks, give me an example of somebody, an encounter somebody, or a difficulty somebody might have walking into a traditional larger bank, and they want to get XYZ thing accomplished. And they really can't do it, that you guys have been able, you've seen your team be able to solve for them. Does that make sense? So where does that actually hit the rubber hit the road in terms of those differences coming out?
Yeah, sure. Well, let me give you a thought process, and then while I'm thinking and talking, I'll think of an example.
Exactly. But, not to put you on the spot.
No, that's okay. I think most organizations, businesses, small, medium, and large, struggle with their relationship with their banks because they don't know how to talk to their banks. Their banks are looking for certain things, and the businesses and banks struggle as well. So we're 50% of the conversation, right?
Sure.
And so the banks are looking for information that is going to be in particular formats. You know, from a financial perspective, I want to look at a balance sheet that looks like this. I need to look at the income statement that looks like this.
Sure.
I want to look at projections, you know, et cetera. And then banks also like to hear the story behind the business, which is really where the business owners are good.
Yeah, right, sure. We're great at telling stories,
But that the bankers really, the community bankers who have an opportunity to sit down with a client and compare and contrast that to the large institutions. In a large institution, you're not going to get a chance, as a business, you're not going to get a chance to tell your story.
Right.
You're going to hand me a personal financial statement, 3 years of taxes, audited financials, and they're going to go to an individual who's going to turn around and put them into an automated underwriting process, and they're going to strip them apart and score them and all that kind of stuff,
right.
Spread them, and then everything's going to be black and white at that point in time. There's no story there.
Yeah.
So I think where we add value as a community bank is we really do want to hear the story behind the business. We want to understand what it is that motivated that individual to start this particular business and where their dreams and their passions and cares and concerns, what it is that they're trying to do inside their community. Because they did it for a reason.
Yeah.
They started it for a reason. Mm. And it's not always financial reward.
Right.
There was something else there that motivated them to say, I'm going to take a flyer on this business. And the small community banks like us, we thrive on being able to hear that story because it helps us in the context of the risk profile of the organization. If I can sit across from a business owner and I can see in their eyes and hear in their heart the passion that they have associated with the bank, when we get into the gray areas, that helps me with my decision making as I'm thinking about a relationship with that particular company. And so I can think of a particular example now that while we're chit-chatting.
Yeah, it's impressive. You pulled it out from the... Yeah,
exactly. And it really had to do with the passion of this particular individual. I won't use the client's name, obviously, but you would recognize it if I shared it with you. And it was about me being able to sit down with him and him being able to take me to his site and walk me through what he was trying to create. And we're looking out at the time, a bunch of land and not much else. Okay. And he had pictures and, sounds and visuals and all this stuff. And today, if you looked at that business, you'd be very impressed with what he built. Now, it had nothing to do with me. I just happened to be able to provide some capital for him to make that happen.
Right.
But it was at a time when no one else was going to look at that opportunity. And that I think that's the difference.
That's a huge difference.
With community banks, because you get to sit down with the folks and you can see, hey, this guy's got something. He's got the background experience, et cetera. He may be a little thin on capital right now, but I see something that's out there.
Hmm. It's interesting. Even hearing you say that, I know for a lot of people, me included often, I've lost, when it comes to individual investors, if I was going to go out or if a small business owner was going to go out, you know that the story matters when it comes to if you're going to go try to raise capital from other people kind of a thing. Right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, they want to buy into and believe in what you're doing. But I've really lost the belief that would even matters to traditional financial institutions because exactly what you said was my experience when I launched my business a few years ago, as well as so the scores of business people I've worked with both before I did this and having done it. There is no sense of there's an institution that I can go with and have a conversation with, and that actually matters.
Right.
Right. I've had plenty of personal bankers and loan officers that I've known or worked with that are great people, and they care personally.
Yes.
But they make it actually very clear. I'll never forget one gentleman that worked at SunTrust that I knew years ago, and I was talking with him about one of our client situations because he had asked me to be a part of talking about their business. And he basically confided to me on the side. He said, look, I think it's a fascinating opportunity. I have zero. He's like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. All that matters is that grid.
Yeah.
And it's a very cold grid, So it's interesting to hear that you would say, I mean, how much, I don't mean this in the sense of, you like the story, you take a flyer. Obviously, you're looking at the financials in depth and you're doing the homework needed. But how much leeway do you guys have in that versus, the institutions where I've seen that it's literally been the only people making that decision you will never meet, you will never talk with.
Right.
They're off in some cubicle somewhere and they kind of look at it and make a decision.
Yeah.
I mean, is it actually people that you're meeting that are making these decisions at your bank?
Yeah. So again, that's the uniqueness with, in particular, the Vinings Bank. We have a weekly OLC, Officers Loan Committee. And it is Dan Oliver, who's the CEO of the bank, Clark Hungerford, who's the president, Todd Maykant, who's the CFO, myself, and Paul Black. And so there are five of us that sit, and we're the ones that make the decisions. And we all vote. So it's not one or the other. It's all of us who are making decisions on those particular opportunities.
That's fascinating.
In any opportunity. And it's paramount for me as I find opportunities to bring clients on who might need capital, and et cetera. I'm going to have Clark come out and meet him, who's our president and chief credit officer. I'm going to have Dan come out and meet him because I want the relationship aspect of that. Mm-hmm. I want them to hear, see, feel the passion of the individuals that we're dealing with.
Man, that it really is. That's unique to what I've seen in so much of banking in general, commercial banking certainly. So do you see then, looking at more of a 30,000-foot view, I feel like usually historically we just see the pendulum swing. We talked about this earlier briefly while I was setting up. We see we tend to react as humans, I think, we swing to one extreme, then we swing to the other, then we swing back. Excuse me, post-2008, there was a definite swing towards people, the availability of capital and availability to get a loan, especially for small business people, just dried up. I can't tell you how many folks I talked with that just could not figure out where to get funding, which would have been accessible prior to that. Do you see a move in overall in your industry, outside of just your bank, the beginnings of a move towards more of this back to community, back to actual conversation? Or is that still a relative anomaly? I mean, where do you see that going in the next 5 years as an industry?
Yeah. I don't think it's an anomaly, but I think it's representative of, unfortunately, the size of your institution. Hmm. And it's really no fault of those institutions, but as you become a larger financial institution and you face more regulatory scrutiny associated with whoever your regulator might be, OCC, FDIC, et cetera, it is invariably, you're going to tighten your business practices to make sure that you're not stepping outside of the expectations of those regulatory bodies. Because the minute that you do that, the pain associated with the sanctions, fees, it's just additional scrutiny, it's just not worth it. And so, unfortunately, I think most larger institutions are tightening themselves up because of the, well, back up 2-3 years, the uncertainty of the CFPB rules that were coming out. Yeah. They were coming, but nobody knew what they were.
Oh, well, and that's a whole different discussion. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. That's a fascinating. And that even now is in flux with the sudden shift. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think there was a lot of external forces that continued to keep the banks conservative in their approach. And by conservative in their approach, not just, ratios and financials and numbers and whatnot, but just in their practices, what I can do and how I can do it.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a size issue. Unfortunately, the smaller institutions, it's not as though we're not regulated in a similar manner.
Sure.
But the scrutiny is a little bit less, and it gives us a little bit more flexibility to be able to have those kind of conversations with folks. And so I think that what you'll see over time, and I'll share some numbers with you, and I'll get them wrong, but they'll be close.
No, that's okay.
As an example, there are about 6,500 banks in the United States today. 2007, there were about 13,000. So you've seen a significant decline in banks, both from failures and then from acquisition mergers, et cetera. Back in 2007, more than 60% of the deposits in the marketplace were controlled by the smaller institutions. Mm. Today, fast forward, if you combined all of the banks that are $1 billion or larger, which is about 4,500 of that 6,500 or so, they control 91% of the deposits.
Wow.
That's like $19 trillion that are out there running around. So 91% of the dollars, deposits, are controlled by those 44,000 or so banks, okay?
Wow.
Better than 50% or more of the lending is done by those institutions that are $1 billion and less.
That's fascinating.
So if you think about that, so that gets back to your question of, practices, where will you be able to go as a small, medium-sized institution and have a conversation with someone who's going to want to listen to you about what you're trying to accomplish and not just black and white numbers?
Yeah.
It's going to be the smaller institutions. The bigger institutions are not designed for that conversation. What they're designed for is you to go online and apply.
Right.
Right.
And who cares if we ever meet you?
If I get your score and it looks like right, I'm in it. Now, there's it's nice because it's volume and it's quick and it's easy and et cetera. But if there's a story to be told.
Well, but most entrepreneurs don't fit in a box. No, I mean, that's the issue. Of course, if you are an established organization, you've been around for 20 years, you've got great financials, and I mean, you can go anywhere at this point, and that's fine. Yeah. But most of the people that are actually saying, again, I see a blank piece of property, I see what it could be.
Yeah.
That's the norm.
Right.
Right. And that's actually who ends up being successful, but it also fails.
That's right.
And you're on that knife's edge.
That's right.
That's fascinating. Do you anticipate, I would love for just people, since you see this all the time and you've worked with so many people and you've made these decisions, you're actually, you know, people don't normally get to see into the mind of someone who actually makes the decisions for, can we trust that this is worth giving capital to? Mm-hmm. You know, what kind of things are you looking for? So if someone is listening, who's actually had a dream, they desired to be an entrepreneur, or they already have a company, they know they need to grow. Mm. You know, what can they be doing to put themselves in a place where, again, maybe not for the Bank of America's of the world, but for they can come to a bank like yours, a small community bank, and have a conversation. What should they be thinking about to get in that position?
Yeah. Yeah, I tell you, the first thing that I look for when I'm talking with entrepreneurs or those that have existing businesses and maybe they want to expand or they want to make their business more efficient or whatnot, I really want to understand fundamentals.
Yeah.
So why is it that what you're doing works? Mm. How does it work? Mm. How do you make money? Mm-hmm. What does it cost for you to produce whatever it is that you're doing to sell or whatnot from a product perspective? And then is it viable and is it scalable? And if it's not viable, then there's something else that drives it, right? It's a very niche business or whatnot. And so, okay, that means different things. That means a different profile.
Sure.
So I think if one encouragement I would give to entrepreneurs out there who are trying to establish a banking relationship is, and this is going to sound curious, but I would find a banker who likes to ask questions and is curious about what it is that you do in your business, because that's someone to me that is trying to understand your business, mm-hmm. and then they can go help solve that problem. If you have bankers that are asking for you, all I need from you, and you hear that, all I need from you
right.
are these six items.
Right.
Right. I want your personal financial, blah, blah, blah. Not that they're bad bankers.
Yeah.
But I need to know so much more than just what the financial picture and profile says to you.
Let me just throw this out because this is fascinating to me. So this parallels what I have experienced in personal banking and commercial banking. And I know that your bank, I mean, you don't work with personal deposits. So you're only working with businesses.
No, absolutely. No, I want to bank the business.
Okay.
And I want to bank the business owner.
Okay.
Because they're one and the same. And so we absolutely have everything that you would need on the consumer side. Matter of fact, one of the things, and this will be sound goofy to you, but we don't charge for banking with us. We make our money on the deposit itself.
Hey, that doesn't sound goofy. Yeah. It drives me crazy. Yeah. When you look at this is a personal pet peeve of mine, but beyond that, it's just saddening to me that when you look at the way, just take one quick look at the amount of money that most banks make on, for instance, I will just say it outright, SunTrust Bank.
Yeah.
I've been with SunTrust for a long time. Every month on my business account, I get charged, dear heavens, what do they even call this? It's not a transaction fee. It's an account analysis fee.
Yeah, account analysis. Yeah. Maintenance and account analysis.
Mm-hmm. I don't know how. I mean, literally, I looked at $160 last month. I don't even know what that even, where does that even come from?
Yeah.
You maybe can explain that to me. But I've had clients come to me and say that. They go, what is an account analysis fee? I'm like, I'm fairly certain in my limited wisdom that fee is simply them going, how can we find extra dollars from your account? Like, what is it? Is it reconciling something or what is it?
Yeah. Well, I can tell you what I think it is, and then you can go check it. So my guess is they've got you in a business account where every time you make a deposit, they're charging you on a per item fee.
Right.
Checks. Anytime you're cashing a check, or usually they're charging you a per item fee there. You certainly have a maintenance fee for your account. It's probably, for a business account, it's probably $35 to $50 as the base. And then anytime you engage with them, so anytime you use anything inside of their systems where their back office processes have to do something with what you're asking them to do.
Which is regularly for us.
Sure. Yeah. What they're doing is they're taking all of those bits and pieces together. They're analyzing them. And so they're going to aggregate those expenses based on your utilization. So how do you engage them?
And that is that fee.
That is that fee. They should be, I would hope, giving you an earnings credit rate associated with the balances that you have, but I don't know what the structure on that thing is.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I mean, all I've noticed is the more, and we're not running around with, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars in our account or anything, but the more that we've utilized, the more we've grown, the more that's grown, and no one ever talked with me about that once, right? So, and I'm not saying it's not, and I remember I called them about this, and I'm not trying to pick on SunTrust, but I called them and said, what in the world are these? And they said, well, it was in your contract.
Yeah.
And I remember when I started the account with them, I mean, you could not have had a faster conversation.
Sure.
Just sign here, here, here. Okay, yeah. We're good. Have a great, you know.
Yep.
I of all people should be the one reading that contract. I get that.
Right.
But it's whatever. The point is, there's so many little fees, and you guys might charge an account analysis fee and all this. That's fine.
Yeah.
But what I mean is, it's hearing anybody say we don't charge you that just to have a regular bank account with us is actually becoming more and more abnormal.
Yeah. Well, in our process, we don't believe in nickeling, diming folks for the little fee pieces of the equation. So what we'd rather have your deposits with us.
Yeah.
And then we'll use those. You know, that's our job. So we'll use those to make money by investing them in loans or municipals, et cetera. I can't make any money off your deposits if you take them and go somewhere else because I'm charging you fees on that.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a pretty simple business that we do.
Unapologetically, fee after fee. Now, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
And it is becoming, I think.
Sounds like you need to talk to a banker.
It's good to know. Well, it's funny, too, because you get so settled. You put so much time
into
building a system that and I see this with clients all the time. It's like I can show them, for instance, a good parallel to this is their property casualty company. You know, we part of what we do with clients, we look at everything a client has, and we don't, not because we sell property casualty insurance, but we're just looking at every aspect of their world. And it's amazing how many people you go, and how long have you been with XYZ insurance? Well, I've been with them for 15 years. Okay. You could probably get a massive discount by just making a shift.
But I know.
It's so much work.
The pain.
Right? And that keeps us locked into maybe unhealthy systems.
Sure. Well, I'm not the brightest light bulb in the box, but $160 times 12.
Oh, man. Now, that killed me. It's never been like that. I don't know what it was. I need to find out. I triggered some switch. There was some change in whatever we did that has caused it to shoot up. So, Yeah, so I might be talking with you more about this. But, okay, so the other flip side of that is, what is the one thing you see the most of? Because I do think this is, again, you just have a unique perspective. Because I found in my business, it's not abnormal for me to, I'm so used to sitting down with people every day and hearing everything about their financial world that I think I sometimes get into trouble because I'll meet somebody and we'll be chatting and I'll start asking questions. I'll be like, really? So about, you know, what do you get paid? And they're like, they're just so off limits. And it's just, I don't even think that way because it's all I do.
Right.
And you have that unique perspective nobody else has of just seeing business after business after business and kind of being able to look at those fundamentals. What is one of the mistakes you see made most often by entrepreneurs that puts them in a bad place for being able to go out and tell that story? Is there anything that you've seen that you go, this is a change you could make, or a pitfall people drop into that you regularly see?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good one. I think... I don't know if there's any one common mistake out there that folks make, but I think the one that I see that's fairly frequent is too much leverage on the businesses early on. And, you know, unfortunately, that's the hard part of starting a business because it takes capital to be able to do that. And, you know, unless you were Mr. Trump and daddy gave you $8 million check or whatever it was, you know, who's arguing at this point, right? Was it a million? Was it two? Was it eight?
Right.
Whatever. Yeah. You know, not most folks get to start their business like that. And so what I really encourage folks to do as they're getting the thinking about they're starting a business or expanding a business or whatnot, first conversation they're going to do is they're going to probably go talk to either their CPA or their attorney. If they don't have a CPA, they're going to go to their attorney first and say, okay, how do I start things, right?
Yeah.
Then they're going to go to their CPA maybe next if it's and say, how should I structure it? You know, Should I be this? Should I be that? And then they put off the banker conversation until they kind of get things up and rolling because they think I don't want to go talk to them because I've got nothing right this. But I think that's where we, you know, Vining's Bank is a little bit different. I would love to sit down with people like that and just say, let me help you. Let me help you put together what you need to be able to go talk to a banker when it's time, when it's appropriate. And in the meantime, there are other venues out there to source capital.
Sure.
And so banks, if you think about that, naturally we're going to have connections with folks out there that do, you know, early stage funds and et cetera, et cetera. And in a lot of cases, I hope in most cases, we're going to know the right folks to go talk with.
Yeah.
Because you can get yourselves into trouble by getting associated with folks that are really not interested in, you know, helping your business other than they are trying to get a return for themselves.
Some of what I've seen is pretty scary.
Yeah.
That people fall into. People walk in, you know, and they'll show me all their, and they're usually embarrassed about it.
Yeah.
They'll show me all their financials, and it's just a shame issue.
Yeah, sure.
They don't want to talk about it.
Absolutely.
And then you look into some of the deals, and it's just gross, out of control, abusive type lending that happens.
Yeah.
Because it was easy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'm just pause on that. It's such a neat thought because again, most people don't look at their bank. You know, if you walked into your local, I feel bad picking on SunTrust. So you walked into the local Bank of America and just said, you know, I know I'm not a fit for you guys yet. I just have an idea, but can you help me think through this? They would just, they would smile and escort you out the door most of the time. That's my experience. There's not that feel of, you know, how can we help you put yourself into a healthy place.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's also, unfortunately, for the larger institutions, but it is what it is. It's a skill set issue. So they don't do that every day. And so they wouldn't know how to give you the appropriate counsel. One, two, they're not going to have the contacts to be able to help you get to where you need to be and who the folks that you need to talk with. Most community banks can help you in that regard.
I bet you've seen some neat stories of it's. You mentioned too the guy or girl who came and gave you a picture of what that land would be, and then you see it come to fruition. Can you? I think it's just encouraging for people to hear about because again, you have a unique perspective on this. Hear about stories, one or two stories of just things you've seen where people came in and you've gotten to watch them go from. Just starting out with a beautiful dream to really living that out and seeing. I'm sure you also have the other side of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
That's part of being an entrepreneur. It doesn't work out. But is there any story that has stuck in your mind over time of watching a real success of somebody walking through that process?
Yeah, I actually do. It's funny that when you mentioned it, it immediately popped to mind. And it was years ago, and it was a young lady. And it's going to sound a little bit corny, but had grandma's cookie recipe. And she was in Birmingham at the time, and we were living in Birmingham. I was working for SouthTrust. And she had a vision for building this little cookie company. And she came in early on, and we talked with her, you know, just we happened to know her and talked with her and helped put the ball in motion. And today, if you went over to Birmingham, you'd know who that little cookie company is. And it's, you know, one of these fabulous stories of just putting things together.
That's incredible.
The other one is, it was an up and a down as well, but it was an individual also in Birmingham who had eyes on starting a sports health a company over there. And you would know who they were. They had a significant rise and then a significant fall.
Oh, wow.
And it was all around making a little $50,000 loan to this individual to start this practice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's all the money in the world at that point.
Absolutely. It was way back then.
I'm thankful. You know, it's funny. When we started our business, I started my business after in the throes of the after recession reality. And I know nothing about this. I knew about what I wanted to do and was passionate about. I knew nothing about financing or lending or anything. And And I did pursue. I didn't win because I saw the value of we need some sort of capital. But I was roundly rejected because I didn't have any. I didn't have at that point. They wanted to see two solid years of financials from the business, which I was just starting. So it was like, well, it is what it is. I'm thankful for that in many ways because I didn't get into what I think can be hugely problematic, which was we didn't start out leveraged, and it was my wife might say. It was stressful at many, many points, right? Yeah. So there we were living on the that knife's edge, and yet I'm thankful now to be in a place where we don't carry a lot of that.
Yeah.
So I see the value of that, but man, I wish I had had what you're talking about, and I would just implore anyone who's listening who's either has a small business or is considering that starting place to say, take advantage of this kind of thing. If somebody's, if you guys are really willing just to say, we're not even coming in expecting you to buy something.
Yeah.
We want, and honestly, you're probably not a fit where we're going to give you anything yet. But guess what? We would love to mentor you in it. And obviously, that benefits you guys over time because if they're the next Spanx,
that's right.
We're all happy.
That's right.
Right. Everybody's thrilled about that.
That's right.
But I've noticed when I went in, and I just have to speak to this because I never get to corner a banker. So here's my chance. Mm. When I go into my bank, and we bank with a few different banks. When I'm in a bank, a number of those banks now, I would liken to used car dealerships. Mm. And it never felt like that to me years ago. Of course, I didn't have any money years ago when I was a youth pastor, right? So they didn't bother. They didn't want me to buy anything. But I can't do anything inside the branch usually without having at least four different products offered by whoever I'm talking with. If I go up to the teller just to take some money out, if I have a personal banker, if I have to be in the bank, I am accosted every time. I'm now gotten used to it. It's have you considered this? Yeah. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? And it's really turned it into a transactional feel all the time.
Yeah.
And it seems like you guys have, I would imagine if I walked into your bank, that wouldn't be the feel.
You would not hear that.
And that is a dramatic, I mean, for me, that's a dramatic, I get tired of having to constantly explain.
Sure.
Look, I'm a financial, I don't need necessarily to have XYZ thing that you're throwing at me.
Right.
And I think a lot of people are experiencing that. So.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And the long story short about that is that took place in the late 90s,
right?
With the need for sales training, and so you had the Cohen Browns of the world and the Richardsons of the world out there promoting sales training.
Oh,
and so what they did is they turned bankers, and this is there's a little bit of a gap from my generation of bankers to the next kind of set of bankers, if you will, and the next really set of bankers. Came out of the financial crisis, because you had to be a good banker at that point in time. So there's this gap between 95 and 2010 where we raised this crop of bankers, and you see a lot of them out there today that are sales folks.
They really are.
And that's what they're taught. And, you know, they use taglines. That's what they'll call those things. Do you want fries with that? How about an equity line today or
it's
whatever?
It's constant upselling.
Correct.
And it drove me a little crazy because I still have a lot of clients that view their bank as this is my safe place to go. Now, the Wells Fargo debacle of the last two, I mean, just absolute. And every line of their business falling apart has been an eye-opening thing for a lot of people, a needed eye-opening thing.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was interesting. I had one client, and the impact of that scared me because I had one client come in. They'd had their money in a money market fund for 4 years, and we're talking the second longest running bull market in history,
right?
And sitting in a money market fund, and they're a young person.
Mm.
And I said, why? Just to add, why is it there? Because I went into my bank, and I don't know anything about finance, and they told me, hey, if you want a great place where you can save, we're offering an introductory. 1% for the first 3 months, and then it's 0.0 something.
Yeah.
It was just that's the practical impact of that.
Yeah,
that there's no it wasn't actually what's best for this person.
That's right.
It was I want to add another line of business today.
Yeah,
and that really woke me up to the impact because I'll just wave it off and walk away, right? Mm-hmm. But the people were trusting these people.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah, if you walked into our organization today. One, you would not get the friendly, hey, how are you doing? You know, good to see you today, Chris. But you wouldn't get the sales mentality. What you would get from us is, how's everything going?
Hmm.
Is there anything else that we can help you with?
Yeah,
and if there's, hey, I was thinking about such and such, and then it's a conversation. It's not a, you know, I've got six products that I need to sell you today, and my boxes over here need to be checked. So
yeah, and
help me with my boxes,
Chris. I hope you'd be the people, too, that would say, because, again, my experience has seen it's, oh, you'd like that, that home equity loan sounds good. Okay, well, let's just fill out an app and see where it lands.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to, well, let's talk about that.
What is he trying to do with it?
Is it possible we could tell you it's not a good fit for
you? That's right, yeah.
You don't even need to apply.
That's right.
It's not a fit, right?
Yeah, or what are you trying to accomplish with it? Maybe it's not an equity line. Maybe it's something else that gets you what you need that doesn't, you know, put you in that.
I really do think the, even though I know a lot of Americans didn't even notice this, but the whole Wells Fargo debacle followed by the data breach with Equifax, there's just, among a lot of people I meet with, the level of trust in just traditional financial institutions has dropped so low.
Sure.
And it's encouraging to, I really do think, and I'm sure you're already seeing this, but just the way that you're approaching that is so night and day different that there's a real desire for that. So that's neat. I'm excited to see.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate
where that goes. And I ask everybody that comes in a few questions and two things that just because I think it's fascinating. So you're obviously a banker. You've been out of college. Were you in this industry?
Yes.
Pretty much from the outset.
Yeah.
So you're a veteran of all of it, right?
All of it.
And when you were when you were a teenager, did you dream of going into banking or was
Absolutely not.
I do always wonder, you know, like no kid dreams of being a CPA.
Yeah.
Like you don't talk to a kid that's like, I know what I want to do.
Yeah.
And yet there's CPAs I love. I never thought I'd be doing this ever. And I love it. But I always wonder, especially people in the financial world, but it's a question I ask everybody.
Sure.
Okay. So when you were growing up, what was one lesson about money or about finances that you were actually overtly taught by someone, either a parent or a teacher, and something that stuck in your mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good or bad, by the way.
No, this one's good, actually. I didn't follow it. Well, I said I did. Maybe I did to a little extent, but I got away from it pretty quickly. But it actually, as I was getting my fabulous education at the University of Alabama, it was actually a GBA 490 class. It was the last class, capstone class of getting your finance degree. So that's when I had a degree in finance. Mm. And the professor made this statement, and it stuck with me, and I've actually passed it along to folks as well. And he said, listen, he said, in about 6 months, this was a little senior year last season, about 6 months, you're going to be making more money than you've probably ever seen before.
Right.
Most of you, right? And here's what my encouragement is to you. For the last 4 years, you've been driving this beat-up old car, whatever it is, right?
And
you've
I had an 89 Buick Century.
So right. Yeah. So I had a 1970 MGB. So you've been driving it, and it's, you know, tattered and beaten and torn and all that. And he said, here's what I would recommend to you. Rather than the first thing that you do once you get the job of going out and buying a car and leveraging, you know, in debt on that car.
Yeah.
My encouragement to you is to drive that thing for another 4 years.
Wow.
Maybe five. And take the money that you would have been making on payments for the new car.
Uh-huh.
And bank it. And then in 5 years, you'll have money to pay cash for the next car.
Mm.
And then repeat that cycle.
Yeah.
So, you know, really small tidbit. And
totally.
But it was absolutely, it's profound. If you think about it today, most folks, as soon as they have that that new job, all of a sudden now I have leverage, right?
Yeah.
And I'm going to be thinking about that future income, and I can leverage that future income. So I think that was a small thing, but made a great deal of sense. I followed it. I think I did. I followed it for the first 4 years, and then after that, not so much.
Okay, that's good. Yeah. All right. And I got to tell you on the car thing, and then I have one other question.
Yeah.
I had to laugh. So, you know, I had an 89 Buick Century, and then we had a Toyota Camry that I bought from my parents. And we lived in Indiana where the weather was miserable, and the door handles would freeze all the time. And I'm like a massive bear of a clumsy human. And I ended up ripping all four door handles off because they would freeze.
Right.
And I'd try to open it and just rip off in my hand. And I'd But by the time I was going into finance, I had been a youth pastor. And, you know, and I thought it was so nice when I got a Mazda 3 hatchback.
Yeah.
But it was older and it had signs of age. And I'm pretty sure one of the taillights was out. And now I'm in the financial world, and I got ragged mercilessly by everyone at the office about my hatchback, Mazda 3. And I got invited to my first investment dinner, where it was all these professionals, and it was really nice. It was one of the steakhouses downtown, and so it's a valet parking and park it. I go in, and then after the event, I've been hobnobbing with all these guys. We're outside waiting for our cars to come up, and there's a Lexus, BMW, Lexus, and they're announcing these people, and then up comes my car, the taillights out, it's a hatchback, and they announce my name, and everybody's, and there's 50 guys outside, and I was like, it's me.
Yeah, that's right.
It's me. So, hey, man, stick with it. It's good. All right, other question for you is, what's one thing about finances that you were taught growing up but that was never spoken? So what's a lesson that you clearly saw acted out, but it was never spoken to you?
Yeah, this is a not good lesson for folks out there. And I don't know, you probably haven't seen it here recently, but you might. In this market, you might. I saw from a number of folks, close relatives and or friends, the propensity to leverage up the equity that was gained in real estate. Mm-hmm. So you buy a home, you put your 20% down or whatever the number is. 5 years later, the market's moved a little bit. Your mortgage has gone in the other direction, which is a nice thing. You've created equity. Mm. And I saw far too often folks taking advantage of that rise in that real estate. And I think that led to some of the issues that we faced in the 2007 timeframe. But hey, I've got this equity that's sitting in here in, you know, in this house. Maybe I can do something with it.
Sure.
Yeah. Maybe I need a boat or something.
Yeah, I could go buy something at a great rate, right?
Exactly right. Oh, it's tax deductible. Interest is, right? Because it's a mortgage. And so I'm going to go get an equity line, or I'm going to go get a whatever it is, and I'm going to leverage that home. And then as the value of that home increased over the next 5 years, I got, you know, some free money there. I'm going to go leverage it. And so the next thing you know, you're sitting out there 15, 20, 30 years later, whatever it is, with a home that's, you know, 85%, 90% leveraged. And one, you know, I mean, what it does is it limits flexibility, because all you need is one market downturn.
Yeah.
And then you're upside down, which we found so many folks. Yeah. And the next thing you know, you got folks flipping keys to the banks going like, it's yours.
A client that came in years ago had a windfall. They had an inheritance from a family, and they took all the money and they went and purchased a house for cash, which for good or bad, it's not terrible. It's probably not what I would have done, but they did. Okay. Yeah. And so for a brief period of time, they were sitting with, they had a house that they wanted. There was no payment on it. And I saw them again a few years later. They had leveraged, literally they had now owed more than the house was worth somehow. Just in taking out debt against the house, and then ended up losing the house, it was just the sad. The progression was so sad because they had been in the place where they really could have been okay,
right?
And they, it was just a temptation,
Mm-hmm.
So that's fantastic. Well, thank you so much for giving so much of your time. And I would just, the final thing is, if people are interested in what you guys are doing, what is the best way for them to find out more about you and just engage with you if they have an interest in pursuing the kind of banking you're talking about?
Yeah, sure. My shameless plug is, so it's Vinings Bank, and it's at viningsbank.com. I'm Mike Sims, and you can get me at msims@viningsbank.com.
Okay.
So that's the easiest way. And cell phone's always easy, too. And I can give you that 404-735-6553, 404-735-6553.
Okay. And you actually are at a specific branch.
We just bought a new office out here on North Point Parkway, and we're getting it staffed up and whatnot in the North Fulton area.
So, and is that open? People can come out yet?
I'm hoping April 15th will be, or 16th will be our kind of ribbon cutting grand opening, but I'm in the office now and I'm there, so they can certainly come on by. I'm not a paying and receiving institution at this point in time. We've got some rules associated with that until we get it completely up and going, but they can certainly come see me.
Okay, perfect. Well, again, we will hopefully some folks that are again, I think it's a stark, and I didn't know this coming. This was not a, you're not paying me to be here in a shame. Right. I'm truly fascinated because I personally, and then with so many clients, have seen such a different reality in terms of how banking is done. So I really appreciate your time.
Yeah,
and
thank
everything
you.
Else. And,
yeah, my pleasure.
Best wishes as you guys launch this.
I appreciate that very much. And you're going to call me on your account, right?
And then, yeah. I don't want to pay those transaction fees. I mean, account analysis.
Right.
I was like, I
don't need that.
I was literally thinking, okay, so there's literally someone there sitting and analyzing. What does that even mean?
Right.
So, yeah. Yeah, I loved it. All right. Hey, thanks so much.
Thank you.